This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
This coffee shop is so boring. I wish I had something good to read.
Wow, you really look bored. I'm Rabble.ca, and I'm here to help. I've got progressive news, opinions, podcasts, video, political analysis. I'm the best company you'll ever have. Want to buy me a coffee?
You're a website. I can't buy you a coffee.
Yes, you can. Head to rabble.ca/donate to become a supporter. At rabble.ca/donate, for the price of a coffee a month, you can help keep me entertaining you, whatever coffee shop you're in.
Rabble.ca/donate. Hey, look at this. There's even a dating column. Rabble.ca/donate. You may be my new best friend.
Thanks for the cup of joe, supporter.
You're listening to Groundwire, community radio news from coast to coast to coast. I'm Marilla Stoyter-Martin.
And I'm Saturn de Los Angeles. This episode of Groundwire was produced on unceded Mohawk territory by CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal. In this edition...
If we get tired of speaking the truth, then you might as well say you have won.
I really love the scene, I really love the music, but I never thought that I could be involved in it as more than like a spectator.
What if the women were white and the men were black? Would we have heard about it? Or would there be such a push to save the men's career?
But first, the headlines.
The Vancouver Transit Police have been accused of racial profiling in light of recent evidence that 328 people were reported to the Canadian Border Services Agency by the Transit Authority in 2013. One in five of the people reported faced subsequent immigration investigation, including deportation. And what is perhaps most concerning is that only 1.5% of those referred to the CBSA had immigration warrants out against them. Here is what social justice activist and co-founder of the Vancouver chapter of No One Is Illegal, Harsha Walia, had to say about the issue.
It's a huge concern because it's basically creating public transit, which, you know, of course, a lot of migrants, non-status, and low-income people in general are using as essentially a border checkpoint. It creates fear and lack of access amongst migrant communities. And basically, transit police has made it their job to racially profile migrants and turn people over to CBSA.
This is Konstantin Prodanovich reporting for Groundwire from CITR in Vancouver.
After another homeless man froze to death in Toronto in early January, people are more concerned than ever about the living conditions of one of Canada's most vulnerable populations. The incident, which took place the week of January 12th in downtown Toronto, has activists calling for increased measures and resources for the city's homeless. John Clark is an organizer at the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. He told CKUT's Victoria Shi that overcrowding is a factor in forcing homeless people into more dangerous situations.
The city of Toronto has been for a considerable period of time in desperate shape with regards to overcrowding within the shelter system for homeless people, and it's produced its share of tragedies. One particular aspect of the thing is how desperately inadequate shelter provision has been for homeless women and trans people.
He went on to say that one proposed solution would be setting up 24-hour resource centers in the city, though it's not likely a project of that kind will become a reality this winter. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Groundwire is looking for grassroots coverage with progressive perspectives, voices, and stories of interest to a national audience. By being aired on radio stations across Canada, your piece will do more than connect communities. It will encourage the self-representation of communities, and that is empowering. For more information on how to pitch a headline, feature, or community radio report, email groundwireprod@gmail.com.
And now it's time for a feature story. The now historic attack on the offices of the satirical French newspaper Charlie Hebdo made headlines across the world and jump-started a debate about racial and religious tensions and the limitations of free speech.
The devastating attacks of Wednesday, January 7th on staff of French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo by extremists gripped the world and have prompted responses of unity and solidarity, including the 3-million-strong demonstration in Paris, January 11th. The satirical paper was targeted for publishing multiple caricatures of the Muslim prophet Muhammad over the last decade. In the faith of Islam, depictions of the prophet are considered sacrilegious. Religious studies professor at Concordia University in Montreal, Dr. André Gagné, explains why these images are deemed so deeply offensive in Islamic religion.
Why target cartoonists? What's the problem with the issue of cartoons? Why is there a part of the Muslim world that's reactionary to cartoons? Even now, the first edition of the Charlie Hebdo that came out 2 days ago, last Wednesday, I think it was the 14th of January, on the cover you had Muhammad. And then there's been protests in many Muslim countries in reaction again to the cartoon, saying, you know, it's an insult to the prophet, it makes no sense, this should be banned, even calling upon, in some cases, against violence on those that perpetrate this kind of thing. But do we have any commands in the Quran or in the Hadith, in the secondary literature, that forbid this kind of representation of the prophet? In the Quran, there's nothing that actually says you're not allowed to draw the prophet. There's nothing in the Quran. What the Quran says focuses more on the idea of forbidding idolatry. So if you talk about idolatry, you mean that you worship other gods. Often in the context of idolatry of those days, these gods were represented somehow physically or in a shape, sculptures or idols, basically idols, they were represented physically. So in that sense, there is some kind of figural representation of a god.
In Winnipeg on January 9th, a gathering was hastily organized by the Islamic community. Over 100 people gathered at the Central Mosque in downtown Winnipeg to stand in solidarity against violence and, according to the organizers, send a clear message to all who wish to divide on racial, religious, and cultural grounds. What follows is an excerpt from that event recorded by CKUW News Director Michael Welsh. The speaker is Shahina Siddiqui, Executive Director of the Islamic Social Services Association of Winnipeg.
People keep asking me, aren't you tired of condemnations? Aren't you tired of speaking up over and over and over again? How can we? How can we be tired to stand up for justice? If we get tired of speaking the truth, then you might as well say, they have won. The terrorists have won. Somebody asked me today on one of the interviews, well, the police officer was Muslim. And I said, my grief doesn't get any greater because one of the victims was Muslim.
While many Muslim groups have come out officially denouncing the actions of the two extremists, the We Are Charlie movement and coverage has been criticized for being Islamophobic. CKUT's Aaron Lakoff spoke with French activist Cathar Bia about the pressure for Muslim people to apologize on behalf of those responsible for the attack.
Well, I feel obligated to say that I condemn those attacks. I feel obligated to say that this Islam is not mine. But I also feel obligated to rebel against this amalgam, as we say in French.
She also criticized the We Are Charlie movement and the reactionary attitude of many towards the attack.
I don't think that the movement Je suis Charlie would turn into such a thing because it's been already deeply duped. I mean, you gotta be duped and really out of touch to proclaim that you are Charlie. I mean, it's too late. I don't think that these people most of them, they don't realize that they are not serving anybody, you know, by not addressing the real issues. They're just diluting the problem.
This was Marilla Stoider-Martin, CJLO News in Montreal. Next, a feature on accessibility in the music scene from the nation's capital.
Last month, a panel discussion was held in Ottawa to discuss accessibility and different forms of barriers in the local punk and do-it-yourself scene. The event, called Freak the Gathering, was coordinated by Emily McCorry and Rachel Weldon from Frequency, a collective of women in Ottawa who organize a monthly pay-what-you-can arts and music event. The discussion was attended by youth, LGBTQ, wheelchair mobile, and people of color, and other community leaders. Marie LeBlanc Flanagan is the founder of Weird Arts Initiatives, a nationwide nonprofit dedicated to encouraging, documenting, and connecting creative expression across Canada. She spoke to how our community prides itself on being accessible and alternative, and yet we perpetuate many of the oppressive systems that exist in the mainstream.
I really feel like in alternative communities, we reproduce the things that are happening in mainstream culture, unless we do something different. That's the default, that we just kind of reproduce it, and that the voices of the people who aren't being heard are continuously not heard. Like, people here today might say, you know, I'm interested in all ages shows and all ages spaces, and all you hear is these like three words, but those people are saying those things every day and not being heard.
Sasha KW is a high school student who's been attending shows, interviewing bands, and writing freelance since he was 14. He talked about the importance of all ages shows.
I think there's a real lack of all ages shows in Ottawa, which we can kind of like work towards fixing. I know it's like there's legal issues around it and it's very difficult because it's really about money and making money at shows with drinks. But a lot of the time when I get invited to shows on Facebook, it'll be like a lot of emphasis on drink deals. Hey, come to the show, maybe get drunk. And it's hard to get out of that because promoters need to make money somehow.
Lily Pepper makes and distributes a variety of zines at two zine racks in Ottawa. They spoke about the importance of alcohol-free spaces.
As someone who's sober and doesn't really go to shows because I don't like being around drunk people, and I don't really like being in a loud and crowded space, I would also really like there to be generally more events that aren't shows. I don't know, I think it's kind of odd that we almost take for granted that the place that people will get together will always be shows. And I definitely try and organize things like around zines and stuff because that's what I'm interested in, that, you know, might be in the daytime or might not be super crowded or super loud or super overstimulating, that might also attract a different group of people who might not feel included or welcome in a punk show.
Chris Binkowski is an Ottawa-based artist who creates electronic music with a mobile sound and light system. As someone who uses a power wheelchair for mobility, he has plenty of experience using back doors, service elevators, or even getting lifted into concert venues. Chris underlined the importance of making venues physically accessible. His voice is quiet, and we had a hard time getting a clear recording of him at the discussion. Chris wrote this for us to read on his behalf. I've experienced many different venues over the years. Some are impossible to get into by having a steep staircase as the only entrance. However, there are many venues that appear inaccessible, but had a side door or entrance through an attached building. Like the Capitol Music Hall on York Street had a freight elevator I could use via a series of attached buildings. Then there are places that are inaccessible by merely one large step. My power chair weighs around 500 pounds, so even lifting it over this step is a true barrier. And all it takes is a simple ramp to bypass something like this. Helpful concert promoters and venue staff are key to overcoming the barriers that have possible solutions. In addition, they often make sure a physically disabled patron feels safe once inside the venue. Elsa Merzei is an intersectional and brown feminist whose interests lie within challenging the white supremacy common in fringe and music scenes. She spoke out about the disproportionate experiences of violence and injustice faced by people of color within Canada.
There's just like a lot of like internalized racism and like, you know, people ask like, why are there no non-white people, or there are few, like why are there only like two people in the whole Ottawa scene like that are white and are doing punk, like why is that? And like, I think like reason number one is like entering like heavily white dominated spaces is just like straight up like not safe for people of color, just because like, you know, like we go through every day like experiencing racism. Like, why are we gonna spend like our spare time in like white spaces where we're more likely to experience racism again? And then like number two, there's like the odd moment that you have like, let's say like a black woman fronting a metal or punk band. She's labeled as like angry, violent, aggressive, all these things, all these attributes that a white dude isn't gonna get labeled as.
Zoe Easton, who is also in attendance, is doing a survey about Ottawa's accessibility and safety in the scene. She works coordinating anti-oppression training for JERS Vision in Ottawa.
We're coming up on our first 100 of people who have like replied to the survey. And there's like a very significant chunk of people who said that they've been touched in a way that they did not consent to in the past 6 months at a show. And I think like, because the majority of people who filled out my survey have been cisgendered women, that it's kind of like an interesting thing to think about.
Sophia Shutenko helped create a zine for the event called Freak the Zine, which looks at gender dynamics in the Ottawa punk community. She interviewed four women who are involved in the scene in different ways, as audience members, journalists, musicians, and promoters.
I really love the scene, I really love the music, but I never thought that I could be involved in it as more than like a spectator. I just didn't think that that was a possibility for me. Almost all of them talked about it. Even Leslie, who is a musician in Ottawa in a band that plays a lot, a really amazing band called Bonnie Doon. Leslie Marshall, she talked about that. She said, until I actually started, I just didn't think it was possible for me because I didn't see any women in bands around me.
Leslie Marshall is a member of the Ottawa band Bonnie Doon. Here she is reading a passage from Freak the Zine.
Ottawa has a pretty interesting scene. People come here and they're like, holy, punk is alive and you guys are the only ones keeping it that way. Across Canada, there are really tight punk scenes, but Ottawa punk, people know about it in other places. And it's growing, which is really interesting. But I was embarrassed. I had friends, you know, my kind of people, hardline feminist artists coming to visit me here because I was like, I love my city, come, we'll go to shows, it's going to be great. And we went to a show once, and it was at the Old House of Targ with my very good friend, Julia Dickens, who runs a Toronto music blog called The Loving Echo, which features exclusively self-identified women writers who write about music because music writing in Canada, not unlike everything else, it's not as much as bad in the States, but there aren't very many women writers represented in Canadian music writing. There's just not a lot of Canadian media. But back to my story. It was so embarrassing. I took her to a show at the Meat Locker, four bands. She's really into punk music, and she's into the community in Toronto, too. Women didn't hit the stage. She said, is a woman going to hit the stage tonight? And I looked over at her, and I said, nope. And I was so mortified about my community. I was so embarrassed. And I'm so passionate about this community, and it doesn't have enough women participating. It's not so much that guys are excluding women. It's that I think it's a mentorship problem. I think people don't see people doing it. I'm very pro see then do. And the only way I was able to do it myself was I kind of got fearless, and I had to. I had to say to myself, you can do it. Anyone can do it. And just from seeing other bands in Halifax and Calgary with women performers and women in bands, it's just that people in Ottawa who do a lot of the community programming are men. And they program their friends. And they're friends with lots of other men. And maybe it means that more guys have to have more female friends. But I just wasn't going to tackle that one. So that's why, even though I felt really excluded and embarrassed, I won't stop. Even though I feel it's exhausting and I'm always that person because I'm very outspoken about it. You know, they're like, oh, Leslie's probably going to say something about this because they have to. It's my job to say something. And I say it to promoters, I say it to labels, and I say it to festivals. I say, is a woman going to hit the stage tonight?
You can purchase Freak the Zine from the Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com. This piece was produced by Ophira Horwitz and narrated by Rachel Weldon. Audio from the discussion was recorded by Mackenzie Smedmore at the Raw Sugar Cafe in Ottawa. Now please enjoy this song by Bonnie Doone called Pizza Shark.
Up next, a report on the Dalhousie Dentistry School scandal from CKDU in Halifax, with audio provided by the Dalhousie Student Union.
Dalhousie University is under criticism after comments surfaced last month from a Facebook group called the Dalhousie Dentistry School Gentlemen's Club 2015, in which male students joked about drugging and raping their classmates. The 13 students, though suspended from clinical duties, will return to study in courses taught separately from their classmates. The incident is seen by many as an indicator of discriminatory behavior at Dalhousie and on other university campuses. Two rallies called Expel Misogyny were held on campus in response to the incident, in which hundreds of students, staff, community members, and allied societies gathered to talk about misogyny and to address the issues that led to the incident in the first place. On January 15th, a panel titled Forum on Misogyny, Transforming Our Campus and Strengthening Our Community, was organized by the Dalhousie Student Union. A simultaneous discussion was held on Twitter with the hashtags DalLet'sTalk and QuestionMisogyny. Afua Cooper, professor of Black Studies and Sociology and Social Anthropology, criticized the media effort surrounding the scandal and spoke to how things would look different if the perpetrators or if the survivors were people of color.
Misogyny cannot be understood separate and apart from other forms of discrimination. So I'm asking all of us to not just consider, but also use and apply an intersectional perspective as we approach this issue. In this postmodern global hypercapitalist moment, misogyny is linked to racism, forms of religious discrimination, classism, homophobia, etc. If we apply a racial lens to the dentistry situation at this institution, I'm sure some would say this would not be relevant, as all those involved are perceived to be white, and whiteness is unproblematized. Whiteness is not raced, and because whiteness is not raced, we can have the luxury of talking solely about misogyny. Misogyny means the hatred of women, or to be more specific, their womb. Let us pause for a moment and consider this. What if the persons involved were not white? What if, say, all the women were black and the men were white? Would it have come to this? Would we have heard about this? Or another scenario, what if the women were white and the men were black? Would we have heard about it? Or would there be such a push to save the men's careers? When race is introduced in whatever equation, the dynamics change. When gender is applied to our understanding of racial situations, then we get a different reading as opposed to the strict and separate dichotomy of race and gender.
Jude Ashburn, the outreach coordinator at the South House Gender and Sexual Resource Center on campus, also spoke on the panel.
You can build the type of community that will have your back. You can build the type of community and begin to understand what solidarity could actually look like if it wasn't based on systems of domination and recreating those systems of domination. I would have to say that there's value in recognizing the double standards here. There's value in having complex conversations that acknowledge my intersecting a privileges and the ways in which I oppress. So it's acknowledging both of those categories so that myself is both oppressed and an oppressor.
This is Laura Peek reporting for CKDU in Halifax for Groundwire.
Up next, the Community Radio Report. But first, here's Where I'm Going by Boyhood. Radio Fund of Canada is one of the main funders of community radio projects and is mandated to support initiatives and promote volunteerism. The CRFC recently announced an increase in the amount of available project funding for stations across the country by $20,000. Executive Director of the CRFC, Jean Malavoy, explains.
The big news is that we're increasing the level of funding that the musician can get. So we're instead of 30,000 for the last round, now a station could apply for up to 50,000 for individual applications, or between $110,000 and $250,000 for a collaborative application.
This is possible because of an overall increase in capital among commercial broadcasters who are required to give a percentage of their budget to the CRFC. Malavoy sees this as a particularly good sign for the future of community radio in Canada, considering the state of other public funders in today's economy.
That's pretty good news. No, I think we're the only funder who's increasing his contribution. Today, if you look at the federal government, municipal government, the foundations, they're striving to survive in a very difficult funding climate. And as for us, due to the generosity of the community radio broadcasters and the CRTC policy, we're able to increase our funding, which is excellent news.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. Produced by Marilla Stoder-Martin at CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal.
Music this week was by Boyhood and Bonnie Doon. Headlines this week were written by Konstantin Pradanovich and Marilla Stoder-Martin. We also thank Emily Macquarie, Frida Worden, Carly Forbes, Audrey D. Luffy, Layla Lemgalef, and Carmelia Farabash.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download this and past episodes at groundwire.ncra.ca. You can also find Groundwire on the NCRA Program Exchange page, radioforall.net, Media Co-op, and on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca/podcasts/shows/groundwire.